Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In Murder in a Sundown Town, author Alexandra Kitty looks at the shocking 1968 homicide of Carol Jenkins, a sweet and resilient 21-year-old woman stabbed in the heart on her first day on the job selling encyclopedias in Martinsville, Indiana. What seemed to be an easily solved homicide turned into a four-decade cold case and became a tragic story about racism, sexism, gossip, and walls of silence. It is a case of injustice and persistence that still leaves as many questions as answers. In an age of both true crime fascination and modern social politics holding equal attention, this book looks at an old case in a contemporary light. From the clues to its racial and gender politics, investigation, resolution, and cultural impact, the book takes an in-depth look at a young woman's frightening last hours and why Carol's case is as relevant today as it was in the 60s. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder in a Sundown Town with my special guest, journalist and author, Alexandra Kitty. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Alexandra Kitty.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. Well, first off, you talk about in the introduction about your previous books that you've written and that this book is a significant departure for you. You usually write about journalism, but tell us about what happened in May 2022, this opportunity that came to you.
Well, I was looking for a teaching job at college or a university because that's my other passion, is not just writing books, but teaching and researching. And I just came across this looking for a researcher for a true crime documentary program. Now, I grew up watching true crime. I read true crime books and I thought, well, okay, I'll put my resume in. They're not going to call me back for an interview, but I'm going to try. They called me back. They said, sure. And even though I didn't have a true crime background, I did write a couple of true crime stories as a journalist, two or three. And I said, sure, I'd love to be a researcher. It's not on camera. And I love reading. I love researching. So I said, okay. They said 10 weeks. And I said, okay, I'll do 10 weeks. And then they kept expanding my contract. So I went through the whole season of 7 months. And I did 8 stories that made it to air. And I really found this fascinating because when you watch it as a viewer, you don't see the tells, you don't see the fit, the process, how you go, because it's a lot of work. You're putting out basically a huge book a week on television, although so little goes into it that you see. But so much of the facts you have to dig out, when they do reenactments, what the victim wore on the night they were killed, that's what the actor who's playing this person is going to wear. The details you have to dig up as a researcher are enormous. You have tons of things you have to find. They might be subtleties on the screen. And I thought, this was one of the best jobs I ever had. And I still say it. It was such a learning experience for me. And how true crime of television's put together. And people don't give it enough credit. This is grueling work. You're constantly looking for information anywhere you can find it, from an inmate search online to what does the inside of the house that where the victim was killed look like? Everything, obituaries, news articles, court transcripts, police files, interviews. You're putting so much into a single episode. I thought this is something that I want to explore more, but as an author. So once I did that, this is probably, it was one of the most eye-opening experiences of my life and one of the best jobs I ever had, because I learned so much on this job that I kind of took on a lark.
Now, you talk about this book. It's about the short life and tragic death of Carol Jenkins. Tell us what it includes. And you talk about resolution and a term you call the echoes.
It's an interesting and heartbreaking case. A young 21-year-old African-American woman named Carol Marie Jenkins, who was, I would describe as an every woman. She was close to her family. She had a job. She was well-liked in her community. She had a lot of friends, and she was resilient, and she was as low risk of a victim as you could be. And yet she was killed right in the middle of a street in a small town where, you know, everybody knows everybody and everybody's there. And yet what should have been an open and shut case was left a cold case for decades. And yet nobody would forget about Carol. I mean, the echoes were Carol. What happened, the tragedy and the injustice that happened to Carol? This case would be, you know, people would scream. It would be reopened every few years. Nothing would come out of it. It would be cold again. People would demand justice. It would get reopened. And so this was a dance for decades. And it didn't seem like this would ever be a closed case. And, you know, miraculously, there was more of a resolution than what would have been, because this was just one of those tragedies where people demanded answers and they weren't getting any, but people weren't going away and people kept demanding and demanding. I mean, even, you know, national press more than once took up the mantle. So, well, why don't we have a suspect in custody? I mean, this case was shocking in so many different ways. You know, here's a young woman walking down the street doing her job and literally died of a broken heart because that's how the killer got to her.
Let's get to this tragic story. You take us to Rushville, Indiana. You say population 6,200 and the proportion of Black people is 1.58%. Take us back to 1968 and Carol Jenkins, a little bit about her background and how she found herself working for P.F. Collier and Son on the streets trying to sell encyclopedias.
So Carol was very, very attractive, a 21-year-old factory worker from Philco Factory. And she was the eldest. Her mother had remarried and her half-siblings all adored her. Her stepfather adored her, her mother adored her. She had many, many friends. But she found herself out of work, like many people, during a strike at Philco. So she didn't have, you know, she needed to pay her bills just like everybody else. So her friend, Paula Bradley, said, well, why don't we sell encyclopedias door to door? That was, you know, a job they could do. So the two of them signed up to sell encyclopedias, which was something that was not in Carol's background. She wasn't a saleswoman. She was a factory worker. But that didn't deter her. So she went with her friend and two other supervisors for them. The supervisors were white males. Her friend Paula was Black. She was Black. And then they decided so she was doing her training. And then this was her first night on the job. So they were running late. They were supposed to go to another town a little further away where they were doing economically better than Martinsville. But since they were running out of time and there was a bad weather, they decided they would go to Martinsville, which was closer. They weren't as well-heeled, choice number one, but this was good enough. So that's where they went that night. They went to Martinsville, and four of them split up. So each sort of took a quadrant, and they went door-to-door selling encyclopedias. And Paula went one way, and Carol went another way. Paula was harassed. Something happened to Carol and she ran for help and things just went spiral downhill from there.
Let's go back, because Carol talks to her stepfather earlier in the evening. There is, when they split up and they go into the neighborhoods, it's not yet dark. You say that sundown was 7:51. And before we go on, let's talk about just briefly what the term, for people that don't know, what a sundown town is.
A sundown town is something that's unspoken, but very well known. It is small towns, which it's very dangerous for African Americans to go after sundown, because there's racist elements, there's racist actors who have no qualms about inflicting harm or even killing somebody if there's somebody who's Black that comes after the sun goes down. So that's where the term sundown town comes from.
Now, you say that she was proceeding in selling her encyclopedias, going door to door. And you mentioned that Martinsville, unlike Rushville, has a Black percentage population of almost zero.
That's right.
She was going door to door. And where we find the first record of anything happening in contact with police and Carol Jenkins was when she came to the home of the Neals. And that would
Don
Neal and Norma Neal. And you say that Don Neal was a 19-year-old man and with his wife, Norma. What does Carol say to them in this first encounter with them?
Well, she knocked on their door and she said there were a couple of people in a car hassling her. So the Neals went to help. Now, I'm going to just backtrack a little. She was already worried about going to Martinsville because her stepfather warned her that this was not a good town to be. Her stepbrother was a very well high school basketball player who had problems in Martinsville. So she was already kind of on edge when she went to Martinsville. And then there were a couple of young men in a car who were hassling her, and she felt threatened enough that she went to the Neals, knocked on their door, and was looking for help. Basically, that there were these people in a car, in a dark car, that were hassling her, and she was looking for salvation. So the Neals took her in. So they went to look. They called the police, and they invited her to stay. They were also very worried about her well-being that night.
What did police have to say? You say there was a police officer that responded. What did he say to Carol and to the Neals?
Well, he said he investigated, he looked around. There was nothing to see here. It was the bottom line. And they took a patrol car, they looked around and didn't see anything, or said they didn't see anything. So they kind of brushed it off. They weren't that serious about Carol's concerns. And the Neals were enough where they offered her to stay for supper, and she turned them down because she said she didn't want to be a bother. So she was a very polite young woman who turned down this, because usually when you're at that age, you don't want to be a bother to strangers who already went over and beyond. They called the police. They went out looking and they made overtures. So they were a very, very nice young couple, and they tried to help her, and she felt like she was, probably overstaying her welcome and that she should go, and probably that was nothing. So she kind of grabbed her bearings and said, no, it's okay, I'll go now.
They had also drove her around trying to look for the rest of her group, or more importantly, one of her supervisors, didn't they?
Yes, and they didn't find either. So Don drove her around. They couldn't find anyone from her original group. They didn't see anybody that fit the description. And instead of getting police to kind of escort her, which they didn't do, she was left on her own after that.
There was a second, to explain to our audience, there was a second time that an officer arrived and offered her a ride to meet her friends. And
she turned it down.
He turned it down, yes. So she was about 15 blocks away from the Neal residence. And it's, you write, maybe within 30 minutes, there's a torrential downpour of rain. Tell us what the Neals, if I'm correct, had given her to help her in this rain.
Well, it wasn't the Neals. It was another woman who was in the neighborhood who was worried about Carol because it was raining, who gave her a scarf. So, and she told the media, well, I gave her a scarf. So Carol did have something to kind of protect her hair by means of a scarf. So this is all that Carol had. There was some rain coming down. I mean, this was probably, if you know, one of the worst first days on the job. You're out, new job, you're trying to go out. It's raining. You're already scared because somebody has made threats to you. And somebody saw her being very pleasant. Everybody who the police interviewed, who she went door to door, said she was unbelievably outgoing, unbelievably pleasant. So she was keeping a game face. And she got a scarf. And that scarf would prove to be a central element of the case. But at the time, it was just something to help Carol not get totally soaking wet.
On her way, on her walk, there's a service station owned by Keith Ford. And just when she gets past that, witnesses hear a scream. Tell us about this.
Well, they could account for all of her movements. They knew where she was going pretty much by interviewing everybody. And then at one point, there's a scream. And somebody had his window open, even though it was raining, and he heard the scream. And he looked out the window and he saw this girl staggering and he ran out. He didn't have a telephone, but he went to a restaurant across the street to call police because this young woman, all of a sudden there was a bleeding young woman in the middle of the sidewalk, and that was Carol. So from being worried then and in the middle of the rain,
yes,
which you think, you know, that you would be safe even there, who'd want to go out. But, you know, she was obviously targeted and they took advantage of the torrential rain where there'd be less likely people to see or even be out. And they took that advantage and they killed her.
Now there's witnesses. And so you say by the time the paramedics arrive, her injuries are so severe, she succumbs to her injuries.
Her heart was ripped. This is how severe the injury was. I mean, she didn't have a prayer. This is somebody who just went with her with such overkill, such violence. By the time the paramedics came, there was no helping. This was a very quick and brutal homicide. Somebody grabbed her and just thrust an instrument into her chest, ripped her heart, and she had an injury on her chin and she had her chest, injuries on her chest. So this was no defensive wounds. She didn't have the time to fight back or do anything. She was completely, completely incapacitated. And as I said before, she was worried and nervous. Her and Paula wanted to buy some sort of a self-defense weapon that they never got a chance to because they didn't have time. But if that would have helped her or not, it's highly doubtful because this everything happened so quickly.
You write that initially when police arrived, they realized that she has not been molested or robbed. And they surmised that her attacker laid in wait, they thought, behind a couple big evergreen bushes. But meanwhile, you tell us, you write about how the police respond initially in terms of gathering evidence, and that it would be up to the Indiana State Police to begin the investigation, and much of the forensic evidence would no longer be available as it was heavily raining.
It was heavily raining, and bystanders were picking up evidence. They found her notebook. They found a whole bunch of things, and without gloves, you have to realize all the evidence was compromised, not just because of the rain, because the police didn't cordon off anything. People were coming up to the police. Here's her notebook. Here's her briefcase. Here's her folder. I mean, when you think about this, you know, even the killer could have come up and given it and then accounted for the fingerprints. We don't know. This is how badly the scene was contaminated. So you have the rain working against you. There's no tarp. Nobody's trying to cover anything. You have people walking off the street giving you things, and you have to take it for granted that that was something that Carol had, or was it the killer? We don't know. Nothing was left where it was supposed to be. So the police had absolutely, and this was a town that didn't have homicides. I have to add this. They didn't have a big experience dealing with murder. So you have people, police who don't have the experience dealing with murder. You have the weather working against you. You have bystanders contaminating this crime scene. So right off the bat, we're now down to zero in this case that should have been at least somehow preserved, but nobody preserved anything. And that's DNA that might have been there could have been lost. It was lost. everything was lost. This is how horrible crime scene management was at the time.
But police are hopeful because this Don Neal had the presence of mind to take down the license plate number. What happens with this license plate number?
Well, he got something off on the license plate number, so it wasn't an easy find. And so they did eventually find the car, and a car with a similar license plate, and they said this guy didn't have anything to do with the crime. So what was a potentially promising lead did not end up being a lead. So this was one of those things where they didn't have as much as they should have had.
You write about September 18th, 1968, a funeral service was held for Carol in Rushville, and mourners and the curious and the disbelieving came, all filing past the casket. But at that time, soon after, police had no suspects. Tell us about the treatment from the Neals, surprisingly.
The Neals, Daniel has passed on, but through the decades, they have maintained what they've maintained. They've always been consistent. But they've also been abused. They were in hiding for a bit because of the threats that because they helped Carol. So here are two witnesses, the best witnesses the police have, who are being threatened and abused and told to keep quiet. So there's now something that pops out. Here are witnesses who are more than willing to help. They were trying to help her on the night she was killed. They were more than helpful to the police. And yet now all of a sudden they are being silenced because they're being threatened with their lives are being threatened. This was a very serious turn of events that, and they didn't get protection. So this was something else. This was another avenue, you know, that could have been completely closed. They did their best, but they were threatened. And you don't expect witnesses to be threatened like this in the town. So, you know, people told them to keep quiet.
How did police respond in terms of the media? What did they order and why?
Well, that was also sort of messy because the coroner gave an impromptu press conference telling people more than he should have. So there wasn't as much in terms of holdback. So they told him to be quiet. The police weren't very happy with outside media. So you're dealing with local media and you know the people and you can present information because those are people you know. But then you had people from larger newspapers coming in asking hard questions that the police couldn't handle and they didn't like. So there was also a media shutout through this case because a lot of the big pieces of information that came out of this came from the big city daily. So they were actually quite helpful. And finding information, it didn't seem to go anywhere. So there were people who rightfully outraged by this case, such as people in the press outside of Martinsville, who they kept getting shooed away to stonewalled and stymied. So eventually even they kind of fell silent. So this was very much one another avenue that, you know, a lot of times you take things to the press, somebody knows something and they come forward. But here, big city papers tried to help and they were turned away.
You talk about, of course, 1968 and the lack of forensic evidence technology and techniques, but there is the 1965 Mercury comet and the idea that police would utilize polygraph testing. So tell us about the suspects that were reported harassing Carol Jenkins that night in the 65 Mercury comet. How did police deal with those suspects?
Well, everybody got pretty much a polygraph. And what was interesting, polygraph cannot actually prove guilt or innocence. And
right.
Yet the police were treating it as if this was, well, okay, he passed the polygraph. So we don't know if the person was prepped for the polygraph, if they knew the questions ahead of time. Sometimes people who are psychopaths are very good at passing them because they don't have anxiety over lying. So they would say, okay, we gave so-and-so a polygraph. He's clear. We talked to them. They were clear. They were throwing the polygraph. They weren't saying, okay, we established an alibi. We talked to it. It was a very uncomfortable way of clearing people was, okay, we have the polygraph and that's key pass. So we don't have to go back. And this would be a sticking point later on because when people were, you know, when they would reopen the cases, that polygraph wasn't what they were using to try to find more information from these people. So a lot of things were lost even through just over-reliance on a polygraph.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, also the reporting and also from the gathers from your writing from the police chief that the way this murder was being depicted was not as a racially motivated murder at all. How did they try to depict this murder?
That's very interesting. One thing, they always took that off the table. This was not a racist-based murder. This was not a racist-based murder. We're not a sundown town. Although even in their own media, newspaper, they were talking about asking a group of African-American book salespeople who were coming into town, well, it's sundown, you shouldn't come. So obviously there was a lot there.
Wow.
But what they did say is, well, it was probably what they was, and I'm using a quote here, a sex fiend. This was probably a sex-based murder because Carol was beautiful. She was attractive, so obviously it had to be a gender-based homicide, as if that was somehow a less offensive. So it was, they had a theory that it was because Carol was pretty. Somebody attacked her because she was pretty. Nobody would, it was, became almost an affront when you're saying, well, maybe it was because she was black. Oh, no, no, no. It was because she was female and she was beautiful. So that's what it had to be. That was the narrative that you heard from decades. From people who were in denial about that it could possibly be a hate base based on racism.
For example, the investigation as well, you write about the two suspects in the 65 Comet. Opposed to Carol Jenkins' claims when she called police at the Neils, what did they say in response to those claims of Carol Jenkins?
Well, they denied that they killed her, obviously. They did say that they might have catcalled or whistled. So it was, well, yeah, we gave her undue attention, but it was sort of the, well, aren't you attractive kind of attention. And a lot of, you know, people were talking about gossiping in the town. And then sometimes you don't, you know, people said, well, I might have had something to do with it. Or they said some, you know, they were taking credit for the crime. The police would come, they would do their investigation, and it was always inconclusive one way or another. So the suspects had good reason to be suspects, just except you didn't have any forensic evidence and establishing timelines at the beginning was not, you know, didn't seem to be a priority because I think the police decided right then and there that it was, they were going to say it was sexually abased assault that didn't go all the way and they just killed her. So there was, there's a lot of murkiness in this case because things were not, that's why the state police were eventually brought in, because it was just any possible potential lead somehow got muddied within the investigation itself. As I go through my book, what should have been and what was were two totally different things.
How does James R. Smith come to the attention of police and why?
Well, basically, you have people who, such as him, who were taking claim. They would get drunk or they would say something and then people would tell the police would come and they would deny it. And what we're talking about are a bunch of suspects who, as I said, they had every reason to be suspects. They said things to other people. There were people in town who went to police saying so-and-so said this. There was one woman who said she knew things. They went to her. She didn't. She was just bragging. So this town, even the police chief finally said to people, please stop gossiping. Please stop telling stories because this, you know, this is already a mess. So what we know about the case a lot of times, and even with our suspects, such as Smith, is basically was gossip from people, people talking, people bragging. And it really was going in circles. This is, to me, what struck me was how much information came from just curious gossip. I mean, when I did true crime television, that I noticed that there would be always a degree of people coming in with gossip, but I don't think I've ever seen any case where the amount of information that comes from gossip came the way from the Carol Jenkins case. I mean, it was almost, for one homicide to have that many people tell stories one way or another, I that may or may not have been true or had elements of truth. This was, to me, quite striking.
Let's talk about another suspect, Keith Ford, and why he's a suspect. And also, you mentioned about hold back evidence, which is a technique police will do to ferret out the truth later with that hold back evidence, as if that suspect knows that evidence, obviously they can conclude they are the perpetrator. Tell us about the screwdriver and hold back and Keith Ford as a suspect.
What was supposed to be a holdback was the murder weapon. And she was, coroner pretty much figured out it had to be something like a screwdriver because it wasn't a knife. And this was considered a holdback, except people were gossiping around town. And that within a few months, was already well known. So that police's holdback, which would have been the murder weapon normally, came out. So that ended up not being very helpful because you had, it was near a mechanic's, she died near an auto mechanic shop. So they figured, okay, the suspect works with tools and it might have been him. So that was another thing that was because the coroner and other people kind of talked about the case when they shouldn't have. That did not turn out to be a holdback. The only thing that was a partial holdback was the scarf she was wearing. Although in the media, they did mention there was a single reference about her getting a scarf. The only thing was that the color of the scarf was never mentioned anywhere. That was actually the only true holdback we had in this entire case, because everything just kind of came out because people were constantly, somebody would find out something, they would tell everybody else in town. It no longer became a holdback. So the screwdriver, which should have been the holdback, didn't end up being a holdback. So, that became problematic too, because every time, as I said, the police said to people, stop gossiping. But once things came out, it became muddied. And you don't know if that's just because it was accidentally muddied or was that by design, where if people know everything, then how do you investigate?
You write about the sensational conjecture, but you also talk about that Joseph W. Summer, the treasurer of the NAACP in Indianapolis chapter, he was calling for action. He sent a telegram to Ramsey Clark, then the attorney general, imploring the DOJ to open an investigation into Carol's murder. And tell us also that they mentioned that KKK had been active in the area as well and part of the history of Morgan County.
Jack, KKK had a rally in Martinsville, not long before the murder of Carol. So people who did not feel safe, Black people in that area just did not feel safe in Martinsville because the KKK went there. The town denied that anything, but you still had a rally in there. There was no doubt about it that there was an attraction there. So the NAACP was kind of getting fed up. They're saying, this should have been an open and shut murder. We want action done. So they asked Ramsey Clark, they asked for it to be open. It didn't get open, which it should have been, because after this, this was bungled and bungled and bungled. And what was an interesting offshoot, there was no murders in Martinsville in that area at all before Carol's murder. After people saw that they could get away with it, there was a bunch of unsolved homicides as a result. So you have here the NAACP clamoring for a justice that's been denied, and they're getting stonewalled. You're now starting to see an increase in homicides in this area because, people figure, okay, I can get away with this. So this became, Martinsville had a horrible reputation. They were deemed a sundown town. So you did not have people coming to this town, not just, the Black community, but other people who were for civil rights and civility saying, well, we're not coming here. And Martinsville suffered economically. They suffered in terms of safety, and their reputation was basically ruined because this homicide was just left hanging.
And you write that no case in Martinville's history had used so much and so many resources. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. Have you ever been so bloated that you just had to cancel out on a party that you were invited to? You would have had to wear your sweatpants. It was so bad. Well, Ritual literally created their Symbiotic Plus with those kinds of stomach problems in mind. It contains clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut microbiome. My wife Lisa and I had already been taking Ritual multivitamins for years already, and then Ritual introduced Symbiotic Plus, and we immediately added it to our daily regimen. We have always trusted the research conducted by Ritual to develop their multivitamin, and now their Symbiotic Plus. Daily 3-in-1 prebiotic, probiotic, and postbiotic with two of the world's most clinically studied probiotic strains to support the relief of mild and occasional bloating, gas, and diarrhea. Why include a postbiotic? It provides fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining and supports a healthy gut barrier. Win-win. Delayed release capsule designed to help survive the harsh conditions of the upper GI tract for delivery to the colon, an ideal place for probiotics to grow and thrive. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide your insides. There's no more shame in your gut game. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 30% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. Now, you talk about throughout this book, when we hadn't mentioned, is that you refer to the process of writing or movies and television and the difference when you're talking about a book and the research involved and just the differences between them. But you also talk and mention about the Injustice Files in 2014. Tell us about the Injustice Files and what it revealed and what it didn't reveal about Carol's murder.
Well, the Injustice Files, Carol was one of three cases in this episode. So this was the first time that we had a true crime show featuring Carol Jenkins. And they interviewed her family and they interviewed the Neils. And well, the Neils didn't realize why they were being interviewed. They thought they were giving an interview just about Carol, and it opened up a can of worms for them. They were quite perturbed by the interview, how it was presented. You know, they were trying to find out who was the other person or who was the person that killed Carol, and they interviewed somebody. They didn't get very much information. So there was not a lot of information in this. So you could tell when you work in true crime on, you know, the other side of the camera, you see tells. So you saw that there wasn't a lot of pictures of Carol. There was no interviews with any lead detectives. You've seen that they were shut up. So you see that they didn't have a lot of information to go on. They had to use other means to tell the story. That's why it wasn't just about Carol. There was two other homicides that this episode was featuring. So even then, when you're doing a true crimes episode, you need a lot more information than most people realize. And you just, because of the way things were handled and investigated, you couldn't actually do a whole episode on Carol, although you technically could. But when you don't have a lot of information, when sources are not forthcoming, the things you have to make up those deficits. And you could see that this was somebody who really wanted to talk about Carol, but didn't have a lot of cards to play about it. So this episode, the people who were, let's say, wanted Carol's murder avenged properly, did not feel like that happened. The Neils were not happy with the outcome of that interview at all.
You fast forward to the year 2000, and you say by 2000, the case would be reopened and the narrative would begin to shift, finally entertaining the possibility that race was the primary motive for the homicide. Tell us about this shift.
Well, when you were listening to the police, when you were listening to the local press there, it was never about race. This was like, oh, could not possibly be about race. And that's why nothing was moving, because when you have a certain lens, you filter out everything else. So a lot of clues over the decades were ignored or lost because it wasn't, you know, didn't fit the narrative. Well, this was a sex attack, not a race attack. So once this started entertaining the possibility that this was a racist or a supremacist that was responsible for Carol's homicide, that's when things started to shift. So we moved away from, well, this was a sex-based attack, to, This was a hate crime based in race. But that's when actually we started to see progress in this case, because now we've opened up the filter to allow for information that could have been previously ignored for that reason. So all of a sudden, Carol's case was open and it wasn't cold anymore. And within, you know, a couple of years after that, we seen the breakthrough. So it was once we started saying, yes, this was, but even people in Martinsville, you know, were digging their heels. No, it wasn't racism. It wasn't racism. But more and more people were clamoring. You had New Yorker do an article, a very, very thorough article on the case. They said it had to be racism based on everything we know. And anybody who looks at this, you know, even half-heartedly will say this was a racist attack, because the same night that Carol was killed, Paula, who was in a different part of town, was being harassed. Now, the two people in that foursome that wasn't harassed were the two white males. So that tells you, you know, we're talking about it wasn't safe for a Black person to be in this town at sundown.
Right. You write about Indiana State Police Detectives M.I. Alcron and Alan McElroy, and they reinvestigated this murder for 11 months, you say, into the second year, and they created a cold case team to solve this unsolved murder. And you talk about the break that they eventually get right in the midst of this reopening of this over 38-year or 37-year cold case.
So yes, they re-interviewed everybody they could who was still alive. Whatever they had in terms of evidence, they actually sent for DNA testing, hoping that something would come. But then they had somebody, a woman, say, I know who did it because I witnessed it, and it was my father. So all of a sudden, from being cold case to somebody finally coming forward saying, yes, I witnessed that murder, my father and somebody else, I don't know who, because the girl was only 7 years old at the time. Her name was Shirley McQueen. And she said, my father, Kenneth Richmond, was the killer. So all of a sudden, from not having anything to having a witness, and she goes, I remember because Carol was wearing a yellow scarf that night. So we knew that that was the color of the scarf. It wasn't even just the scarf, because there was a single reference. I went through every media outlet that covered it during the time, and only one person interviewed the woman who gave her the scarf. And she didn't say what color it was. She goes, it was raining. I gave her a scarf. And nobody knew was the one thing, the only holdback they actually had was the color of the scarf. And this woman remembered the color of the scarf.
The Shirley McQueen, though, you write, though, she did not just one day pick up the phone and call police. There was over the years, and she had told other people. So explain this process that eventually she was spoke to police.
Well, she told her former sister-in-law, she did tell people over the years in confidence. She was too scared of her father. Her father had a criminal record. He never seemed to be convicted of anything. So he was accused of homicide before. So let's not, and he had roots to white supremacy. So he was not a safe fellow to disobey. We'll put it to you this way. And so she told people, and eventually her sister-in-law said something, went to the press, to a television station. Eventually, Carol's stepfather hired a private investigator who was a former state trooper. He managed to find her. So all of a sudden, from multiple angles, this sort of kind of broke open, because I guess she told more than one person, and it started to come out. So some people in the press got a hold of this. A private investigator got a hold of this. So finally, after so many decades, it migrated to the police. So she was very reluctant to tell the police, but she told other people, and those other people started putting feelers to police, to the press. And that's how it finally, where she got the courage to go to the police directly and say, yes, I'll testify.
You say by May 2002, it's finally revealed the name, Kenneth Clay Richmond. You write in this book about his psychiatric background. Tell us a little bit about Kenneth Clay Richmond.
As I said, was a very dangerous fellow. He was accused of killing his friend. He castrated himself. He was not somebody you fooled around with. He was in a psychiatric hospital. So he was somebody who we would say was ultra violent. He was not stable. But he seemed to be he seemed also to be just as much charmed. Whenever he was up against something, he seemed to skirt the consequences of his actions. So Carol's murder was not the first one that he would have gotten away with. There was always some sort of technicality or something, and he was never really held accountable for his previous violent actions.
You say that he had other offenses. Even you say he was abusive to his wife and kids, this Ruby Walsh. He even stabbed her, and he had an offense of stabbing a police officer as well. And it was well known that he hated Blacks. That was something that everybody knew. It came from his mouth.
Exactly. Everybody knew. I mean, he was open. This wasn't some sort of secret double. Neither his violence nor his hatred of people who were not like him was a secret. He was very open and very proud. So this is, you know, somebody you would not want to have anything to do with. He was dangerous, but he was free to roam. And there were a lot of casualties. I mean, he was abusive to his wife. He was abusive to his children. He was abusive to his whole circle. He was not somebody, I mean, damage he did to himself. So you know that, what are you going to do to somebody like this who can do things to his own body without flinching?
This is found out a little bit later, but you write that what his daughter claimed, Shirley claimed, happened. You write in detail what she said her father did and said.
Well, he grabbed her, his companion grabbed her, he stabbed her.
Wow.
And yeah. He threatened his daughter. He gave her $7 to keep quiet because she was 7 years old. They gave her $1 for every year she was alive. So he said, keep this to yourself. Don't tell anybody.
Incredible.
So for years, she was scared. She didn't tell anybody for years because she was scared out of her. I mean, if your father can take a perfect stranger off the street and ram a screwdriver, and which that was his profession. He had made perfect sense for him to have a screwdriver. So he was good for it. But she was too scared to say anything to anybody for years. She was an adult when she finally was able to say, yes, my father did it, but she was scared of him. And she had very little recourse because he had no inhibitions. He was a psychopath. He did stuff that would horrify most people, and yet he could do it no problem. And here's a little girl who has to carry this burden on her, terrified. Well, what if her father changes his mind and gets rid of her just to keep a witness quiet?
You write about, I say, the $7 reward to keep her mouth shut, but also that the two perpetrators were laughing when they returned to the car and said that she had it coming to her. She got what she deserved.
He was heartless. I mean, this was something, to laugh, you're killing a perfect stranger who's never done you any harm, who's not doing anything, just working. She was working. Carol was working at a job and was just terrorized and then murdered in cold blood, right in the outside, right in the open. I mean, you think, okay, you're in a small town. It's raining. You don't think anybody's going to bother you. And here are these people coming, and then they left. I mean, here, your family is going to be destroyed for the rest of their lives. These people are laughing. And this young girl, this is what she was exposed to. She was exposed to somebody at a very, impressionable age. Well, it's funny to kill somebody. So, kudos to her not losing her moral core over this horrific, horrific turn of events.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You also write that, just to lay some credence to your assertion that Carol would be afraid of her father, in 1985, years after Carol Jenkins' murder, he killed his friend Samuel Leverett, but he wasn't convicted of shooting his friend. All he was convicted of was illegal possession of firearms. And you say really what happened was, in the court case, they had difficulty convicting him of manslaughter, and the manslaughter wasn't an option available to them. And so that's how he ended up with illegal possession of firearms. and only a short 4-year sentence for murder.
Well, he kept getting away with things. I mean, there was always some sort of dark charm with him. He would get away with things. So that had to play in Shirley MacLaine's mind. My father gets away with killing people. So she's seen him with what he did to Carol. She's seen him. So it was not an easy thing for her, a burden to carry. And so she carried it, as she did confide in certain people. But eventually, something like this eventually is going to end up in the direction of the police. And that's when things started to change in this case.
You talk about his arrest. And now, unlike in the beginning in 1968, it makes national headlines. But there still was no information as to his accomplice, was there?
And there still isn't. It's actually still an open case. The FBI still is looking for the second accomplice. Whether he's dead or alive, we don't know. But most likely he's not. But it is that we only know half the story. We don't know who the accomplice was, because Shirley was too young to know where they dropped off the accomplice. What was his name? Who he was in relation to her father? So we don't know everything about Carol's murder. We just have one half of this from the one who was the instigator. So he was the main instigator of the homicide. It was on his order and say so, because he's the one that stabbed her. The other accomplice just held her down to be stabbed. So we're still not entirely clear about who was the other killer. We just know there is another one.
Now, right away, there is a need to take this guy to trial. And so right away, you say, right from the very beginning of this trial, it's a battle. And so there are battles for such things as the psychiatric records of both people, Shirley and her father. And of course, the defense lawyer named Litz is putting on a very aggressive and vigorous defense. Tell us in this battle before.
What happened was that this Litz, his lawyer, Richmond's lawyer, was very, very good at being a defense lawyer. He wanted the daughter's psychiatric file, which we could say it could have been in a form of intimidation.
Right.
She would, of course, have psychological problems if she's witnessed a murder.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to have problems being with an abusive family and being scared out of your mind, especially if your father killed before and got away with it. And this lawyer, every way he went, he goes, well, I'm going to show what's really happening. He didn't do it. He was quite cocky. And what happened was, this client eventually got very old, very sick, and passed away before he could go to trial. So he actually managed to keep him out of, he couldn't even have a trial at the end because the prime suspect expired. He had cancer. He was sick. He was old. And so the family didn't even get to see what evidence they had. They didn't even manage to present the case in a court of law. So this was also something denied. So we never got to see the full case from the police over the decades, because they reopened this case quite a few times, probably once a decade at least. They tried to open this case and nothing happened. And then again, we don't even know who the second person could have been. So what would have been put in trial? What evidence, other evidence? It would have been very interesting to know. The national media, even international media, this caught the attention of a lot of different places. People wanted to know. And they never got it. It was, he just died. And he died never being convicted of the murder.
You write about what happens after, what this trial represented, but also the aftermath. Tell us about what is concluded after this. And certainly there was no conviction. What was concluded after this? What was said in the media? Tell us.
Well, basically they said, it's pretty much, people believe it was Kenneth Clay Richmond. There was circumstantial evidence. There was the testimony of his daughter. There was the holdback of the scarf, his views. He went that way. This route was not unfamiliar to him. And there was a park erected in Carol's honor. There was a plaque in Martinsville, which the Neils really had to fight tooth and nail to get a plaque in her honor. Even the town, the city hall did not want to give a plaque to Carol. So it was a battle. And at that point, Daniel was dying of cancer. He goes, I want to see this before I die. This young woman haunts me to this day. We will never forget Carol Jenkins. So he and his wife, Norma, never forgot at the ceremony Paula, who was the young woman who talked Carol into going for this job, who was there on the night she was murdered, came to the ceremony, and she never stepped foot in Martinsville since the murder. So this took all her courage to come to the ceremony. So we know some of the case. It's not fully closed case because we know that there's another person potentially, and we know nothing about it and may never know. We may never know the full story of Carol, but she seemed to have been, after the murder, she almost was forgotten. And yet this is still an open case, yet we still have somebody else we could find. And just kind of vanished after a while. And it's a shame because this is something that we should really remember. This is something, you know, how many young people go on their first day of work and then get killed so viciously, which she just was walking down the streets, picking herself up after having been shut out from her previous job in a factory. So this was a very hard working young woman. And her friends were always devastated. There was one young girl who paid for a newspaper ad in memorial for Carol a year after she died. And a lot of times this case would have even been never looked at, but her family would go and put ads in memorial to Carol every year she died, hoping that that would force people to reopen the case, pressure the police to open the case. So in the spirit of that, Carol, we know as a victim of a hate crime. And that it was one of the most important hate-based homicides in the United States. And it doesn't get the attention it deserves.
It's a shameful chapter that you write about in Martinsville and the area, but also that seems that the state police were the only people investigating. And it seemed like the local police chief and the local police had many reasons to not investigate as fully as they may have.
There were, of course, rumors why they did. Of course, there were counter rumors and all sorts of things. But if it wasn't for the Indiana State Police, I don't think this would have ever been even resolved that much. They had two very good cold case detectives who came in and said, okay, we're going to take another crack at this. They did other cold cases. So they were well-trained and they were serious, and they didn't look through leads. They retested things. They reinterviewed people. And it wasn't until Shirley McQueen came forward and said, I know who did it, and they found her credible. That I should mention, they had other evidence and everything else, but they believed her enough that they would charge her father. They didn't have to if they didn't believe her. So they must have been an awful lot that they had to debate. Do we arrest this man or not? Do we do this or not? How strong is her testimony? She was willing to testify, even though her father's lawyer was threatening to demand that her psychiatric information be made public. He could look at it and make public. So she was a very brave woman. This could not have been easy for her.
You write in the end that Carol's story is far from over. And I would agree with you and say that, especially with this book, her story and the lessons from her story very much will stay alive.
She's, as I said, a very important figure. She was a very modest young woman and, you know, hardworking. She was, you know, she would have been anybody's dream daughter. She would have been anybody's dream employee and or a friend or a family member. And she was just taken. She was just swallowed up in the night. And we have to remember, Kara, she did everything right. She did everything right. You know, a lot of times people always go, well, what did the victim do? Well, she was hardworking, self-sufficient, resilient. And, you know, that's who she was. And if we are to honor her, that's how we should be treating other cold cases. Resilient, persistent, and not forget. So I really wanted to write this precisely because I thought we don't really discuss this case. And this is yet such a historically important case. And my experience writing true crime shows us this would have been absolutely perfect on one hand for her story to be told in this format. And yet there were so many obstacles and that it defied those telling in this format because things were botched. There was a lot of rumor and gossip. Things were not clear. You had a town in constant denial that they had a racism problem. They took offense to being called a sundown town, even though in the press, you had people, you know, police telling people who are Black, don't come here, it's sundown. And then say, well, how can you call us a sundown town?
Wow.
You know, basic research will tell me that. So that's not something, you know, you should be feeling good and safe. Doesn't matter who you are, going in any town, doing your job, or just going for leisure and come back alive and not have to worry about something. She was scared out of her mind going there. She was more scared when people started to harass her. And then when her final moments were, you know, and all she did was be brave and do her job.
It's also a story about the bravery of Dawn and Norma Neal and their incredible effort to try to protect Carol Jenkins that night. And also the hard work and persistence and diligence of Carol's family, Elizabeth, her mother, and the family to be able to fight for this case to be reopened and solved.
She had a lot of advocates, and a lot of times people fall in the cracks because they don't. So you can imagine you have a whole bunch of advocates, the Neals, her family. You had people fighting for her, and it's NAACP, a lot of civil rights activists, and it took decades before her case was resolved.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Murder in a Sundown Town. For those that may want to take a look at other information or your other books, do you have a website and do any social media? Tell us about that.
I have alexandrakitty.com. There's more information about the book, and I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn.
Thank you so much, Alexandra Kitty, Murder in a Sundown Town. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening and good night.